Great. All right. Well, welcome to everybody. A very warm welcome to Robin Grill, who's talking to us from Sydney, a rather smoky Sydney with all the fires going on there.
Indeed.
So Robin is a psychotherapist, but he also runs workshops really around the world, travels a lot, and running workshops on parenting for therapists. And he's recently written a new book, which is called Inner Child's Journeys. But he's also the author of a couple of other books, Heart to Heart Parenting, and Parenting for a Peaceful World. So he's going to be talking to us about his work and also his new book. So over to you, Robin. Thank you.
Well, John, thank you so much for having me on this program, and I'm enjoying meeting you guys, both of you, So I guess to give you a nutshell about my work, I'm a psychotherapist. I'm a psychologist. I work with families. I do a lot of relationship work with couples. And I became fascinated several years ago, late last millennium, actually. I became fascinated with the history of childhood. I'll tell you what, I love the power of story to bring up compassion. It's that experience that when I meet a person, even if I don't initially like that person, even if I have judgments and resistance and whatever, getting to know a little bit more about the story of the person, how it felt to be them, particularly when they were young, when they were in their formative years. There's a helpless, like an automatic response of compassion that comes forward in my body. I love the power that story has to bring that. It's the closest thing I know to some kind of forgiveness. And in the large scale, what fascinated me, that drew me into writing my first book, was that as I read the story of childhood around the world and the way that the different cultures all over the planet have customarily related to their children, it suddenly gave me enormous ahas about why so much of humanity behaves so viciously in our world, why history is riddled with war and dictatorship and abuses of all kinds and slavery. It was just a watershed moment for me to realize that it's not that human beings are intrinsically brutal. We're born with certain temperaments, but absolutely nobody was born to be depressed or violent or broken in those extreme ways. And that I found that extremely exciting. I needed to write about it. I spent years researching it. The book came out. It was born in 2005, Parenting for a Peaceful World. And from there came many invitations to speak. And my work moved more into the sphere of, I guess you'd call it parent coaching. So my second book, Heart to Heart Parenting, was more directly a conversation with mums and dads. You know, I'm very interested in not only the developmental needs of little children and how important it is for us to understand those needs so that our children generally have the best chance to grow up in emotional health. And we're blessed to have so much science behind that now, brain science, et cetera, as you know so well, that we can have a much, much better conversation about what children need for their emotional well-being. You know, it's like the modern generations want, we're asking for something more than just being providers to our children. We're not satisfied with just the food on the table and the roof and the schooling and the clothing. You know, we want to connect with our children on a much more holistic sense of it's kind of like humanity's collectively awakening to the primacy of emotional well-being and how much of all of success in our lives springs from emotional intelligence and our ability to connect at the heart level with one another at will. So I just can't help seeing the personal and the political, the larger social thing simultaneously. You know, it's each individual child, but also how as a society we collectively care for our children and how that sets our destiny, including when my country is currently incinerating itself and insisting on its entitlement to keep on selling fossil fuels for our own comfort. What has gone wrong there in our collective childhoods that we can be so desperately detached to the present day suffering of the biosphere and every other human around the world? You know, it's not enough, I don't think, to call it greed. It's a wound. It's a collective wound, and beginning from, you know, our time in utero and birth, as you know.
Yeah. I mean, you probably know, Robin, that we're going through an election today in the UK.
Oh, yes.
I love what you're saying about the compassion arising and, you know, when you're working with families. I mean, there's a huge beauty, I think, in struggle, you know. You said none of us are born depressed, or I'm just wondering how you kind of work perhaps with, because I know you work mostly with parents rather than children, is that correct?
Yes.
Particularly around, because I work a lot with babies and mums as well. We know, don't we, that like womb experience and, for example, on a very basic level, stress during pregnancy or adverse events during pregnancy can affect the baby growing in the womb, and that may have later ramifications. I'm just wondering how you work with that sort of like prenatal kind of influences, because when you talk to a mum about like stress in pregnancy, it's very easy for them to go into guilt. And I've been fascinated by guilt and how useful or not that is as a felt thing for mums. Could you talk a little bit about that, how you work with that?
I'm also fascinated by guilt. And that's, if anything, oh my goodness, there's so much to say about guilt. And so much to do for guilt. I think you've asked me a couple of interesting questions there. One is about how do I work with people for whom the wounding comes from such a pre-verbal place in their lives that there's highly unlikely to be any narrative memory.
Yes, I find that interesting. Yeah,
it's a very unique kind of a challenge. And but there is method, there is language for that place. You know, here's one thing that's been understood so well that psychotherapists, particularly the body-oriented psychotherapists, have known this and felt it and been talking about it for decades and decades. But now that the brain sciences have actually explained the phenomenon very well, which is what they call implicit memory, I prefer to call it body memory. Very simply, that states that even when we don't have like that movie in our heads kind of memory of what happened, such as, for instance, for me to say, I can't remember the moment of being born. That's narrative memory, which comes from a separate structures of the brain. Body memory is that even though I can't so-called remember, my body recalls sensation and emotion from that time quite easily, actually, and that's subject to triggering. So body memory is triggered upwards through a similarity of state. So that's why, for instance, we can smell something and be transported back to a time in our lives where that smell was important, or we can hear a song that just takes us right back. Suddenly we're 17 years old again, in the arms of our, you know, darling, dancing for that at that song in our high school, or you know, you hear a noise and you have a reaction that's really all the way back to a traumatic experience, sometimes from before you have narrative memory, etc., etc. All of our relationships become those triggers. In our intimate relationships, frequently, you know, we think that we're fighting with one another. A lot of what's actually happening is I'm fighting with my own past. Something you said or did pressed a button that takes me back to an unresolved, painful place. And why I'm confusing you with my past right now. I think that I'm hurt by you and mad at you, but I'm because of body memory, what happens is there's a neuroception. There's a perception that's driven by my neurology, which causes me to project. I see you as a threat that essentially you are not. It could be even that you've just pressed the button about my obstetrician, who was very cold and harsh and terrifying. On the day that I was born, that's it can go back that far, in fact, a little bit further back. So how do we then speak to that place when usually, you know, the great majority of people won't be able to articulate to you if they're your client. They can't say, I've got all this stuff coming up for me from the third trimester in utero. That's incredibly rare. It happens, but it's incredibly rare. And that's where it's important to understand the kind of things that are likely to come up developmentally from the different stages. That, for instance, you know, in the womb and through birth and in the very perinatal stages, there's almost zero ability of fight and flight. We cannot escape a shock or something terrifying. The bright lights and noises and the medical instruments and the panic that's going on, etc. We cannot escape. Or if we're not being held and welcomed, there's no place to run from that. And we feel everything so much more acutely than we do later on as an adult. Their nerve endings are just exquisite. So the only defense available to a newborn, and it's usually an experience of terror when things go wrong. It's not shame or worry, it's terror. And
yeah, and I'm also assuming, sorry, that's also linked in with survival, isn't it? Like, because...
Yeah, life and death kind of terror. I was going to say this, yeah, the only defense available is about dissociation, is that kind of response where you can see it in babies where the head drops back, the eyes go here, and there's a limpness and they're no longer there, although the body's still breathing. And that dissociative response and big shocks or an ongoing kind of not receiving and responsive warm environment habituates that dissociation. So when I can be working with somebody who's 47 years old, but when I see in their body that startle response, that or that frozen nature, that great split between thought and emotion, and my body responds to that with wanting to be incredibly gentle to that person. And it's almost like an intuitive sense that this kind of material, this way of orienting in the world and defending in the world, seems to come from something that far back. So that in a way, even though you can't tell me that story, your body is telling that story. That's where behavior and our way of holding ourselves is biographical. And that can be responded to, which is what I'm so excited about. That material, that call to be made safe again, can be responded to without even having to necessarily engage the narrative of what happened to you. You know, your body's telling me what happened to you. And maybe I'm wrong in the content, but however, that protective response of holding is still going to be good for you. So I guess that's one example of how even when you can't speak for your body is speaking for itself so well and indicating quite a lot about the stages of your development that your wounding came from, because it looks so different when it's an attachment wound. So very, very different again when it's a wound that comes from the toddler stage, which is usually more about boundaries and power and voicing your feelings and being allowed to be angry, or the right to be playful often gets damaged. And then even later in the adolescent stage is a whole different set of issues that the defenses that build around those wounds are totally different family of defenses. So behavior really indicates the distinct developmental stage from which most of your wounding arose. And even when we forget those things and bury them consciously from our conscious mind, that's why we use the word inner child. It's a metaphor, but it's as if the inner child or inner baby or inner adolescent never, ever, ever gives up asking. You know, we hide from each other, but something continues to, I want that story to complete. I want that cycle to complete. You know, even, and it's never too late. At 53, at 67 years of age, the door never shuts on that stuff.
No, yeah. I don't think I'm still working with it myself. You mentioned, because we've been doing a series on neuroception and Stephen Porges' work, and you mentioned about the safety. And I'm just wondering, like when you're working with parents and babies and stuff, I'm just wondering how you help to create that safety, because that's kind of key, isn't it, as a first baseline, really, isn't it?
Well, there's a bunch of things that are, I think, really essential. An agreement on confidentiality. The stories that you tell me, I'm not allowed to tell anyone else without your permission. So there's a privacy that you will be promised. And one of the things that creates a feeling for safety, a feeling of safety, is that if I allow myself to be vulnerable enough to be impacted by you, that you can see that your what you share of yourself is having an effect, you know, and hopefully I'm not so blank that you can see me being moved by your presence. And I think that's how you get the signals that you're not alone. That even if I only just met you, on some level you matter to me. You tell me about your pain and something in me goes, ouch. And if that ouch is visible enough, you know, it's not that I'm going to start crying and make it all about me and steal the show from you. This is for you and about you if it's your session. But to know that you've made a contact and your presence has an impact, I think is an essential demonstration of connectedness that is part of the engine of helping people to feel safe. And I do carefully, and I pick my moments as carefully as I can, but disclose a bit about myself so that there isn't this kind of power differential where I'm intact and you're in pieces, you know, that I've got some breaks in me as well, and I'm still working so much of it out, you know, and I'm on a journey. I really don't have any sense that I'm healthier than my clients, that there's some kind of a continuum, you know, where I'm, you know, more advanced and you got the problems. It's just, that just doesn't make any sense to me at all. So it's more of a mutual space that I seek. And I know that makes a big difference for me when I go and see my therapists that I've seen so many of through my life. all of those things matter to me, and when I'm in the other chair.
Yeah, it's very easy as a client to see your therapist as somehow, oh, they've done all this work, they must be really clear now, and
and immediately, you know, there's a part of me that fantasizes my therapist being, you know, like the guy that has it all together, and simultaneously that makes me feel a little bit smaller or ashamed of my stuff.
Yeah,
and it just brings in a whole other thing of shame in there, and that makes it harder to talk about myself and harder to appreciate my own being. So I think part of safety too, by the way, is that we do need to have some kind of contracting. You know, what is it okay for me to do or say? You know, what's not okay for me to do or say with you? So, you know, really it makes me think about all of the things that most of us didn't have done for us when we were babies. And it's kind of, I guess, you could look at it as role modeling a way to connect that had not been or had been too rarely available or sometimes not available at all in the time of growing up. And practicing, for me, the goal of healing, I think healing, I see it as synonymous with connection. What we've lost through the wounding and the shocks and the trauma, we've recoiled into ourselves, where it's just been too agonizing to reach out again after a while. It gets too painful. To reach out and say, you know, that I have needs, or that I just, or that I love you, or I don't want to be alone, all of the different languages of reaching out, that gets kind of, you know, held back, or we reach out but then we don't receive. Somewhere in that cycle it gets broken behaviorally until it feels normal, until we forget what we were ever reaching out for in the first place. So to me, healing is the return to the ability to connect when we would like to connect that will, to connect with one another deeply, right? That emotionally alive connection, and then to come back to ourselves when that's fulfilling, to come back to a connecting with ourselves, privacy, connecting with the non-human world, feeling our oneness, that vibrant sense of family, like that tree is me, that animal is, that horizon is part of me somehow, those connections. So to the past doesn't remain with us, but the way that we defended from the scary parts of the past, that stays in the body. And we're afraid to let that go, but at the same time, that you could say the child inside us will not give up wanting to, come on, I want to relearn how to connect. I want to reclaim what I once had that I lost or that was taken from me. And that's an interpersonal thing.
I often think, Robin, about, you know, when you're talking about connection and stuff, and you started talking about what's happening in Australia with ecology, and like a lot of our disconnect, you know, when we're disconnected from the land, if you like, we can do these terrible things to the land.
Yeah.
And often I've noticed also that people, when they're challenged, they often go into like shame, you know, and that's not a very good place to relate from, you could say. When people go into the shame, I think we tend to cut off a little bit, don't we, because it's too painful. So I'm just, I know we're skipping around a little bit here, but we talked a little bit earlier about guilt, and again, how from my perspective and in my work, I often find that quite difficult when you're particularly with maternal guilt. I mean, for some reason mothers seem to go there quite quickly.
Oh yeah, so much. Yeah,
for example, a lot of, in my work, many mums wanted a particular kind of birth, and then that doesn't happen, and then they get disappointed, and there's all that, but there's also tremendous guilt, and that almost creates some sort of barrier to communication somehow, you know, mum and child, and you know, it's quite easy for mums to get lost in that. So I don't know, you've got some thoughts about guilt, and I've often wondered about how, is that a useful, can it be a useful, I don't know if you call it an emotion, but certainly a feeling or a thought process.
Well, I have found that guilt and like you, I hear it more in the voices of mothers. It's not absent in the father's universe, but maternal guilt just it seems like a enormously shared agony, and that this is what drove me to write my third book. After writing my second book, Heart to Heart Parenting was about child development, and also what mums and dads need, what children need, what mums and dads need in all those different stages of development. And I could see that so much of the new information about all of that stuff has cast a gigantic, excruciating shadow of guilt around the world, because now everybody knows what we can get wrong and how we can damage our children. And there's all the brain data around, and oh my God, my child is going to be damaged from what I did. And my experience of that guilt is that it shuts doors and it builds walls incredibly, that makes any kind of compassionate and growth and learning almost completely impossible. One of the things around the perceptual side of guilt is that I did this to my baby. It's interesting how that's this narrative. What have I done to my baby? And the flip side of that is, I hate you for being the person that brought me that information. How dare you? Because you made me feel guilty through what you said, at the effect of your information. So that narrative is so tiny. It's the what's missing from that picture is, it's not what I did to my baby. It's, look what happened to us. Look what happened to us. So there's a kind of sort of a heroic superhuman self-expectation to think that in the face of the sheer weight of our, for instance, when a mum gets lost in that hyper-medicalization of birth, she's so trapped. And she might have her, for all of her best intentions, the birth plan that she has been helped to long for. But sometimes, you know, a person is outnumbered and outgunned by the culture, the sheer formidable weight of it. Somebody comes in with a white coat and says, that's all very well, but it's the power of those words. And when a mother is at the most vulnerable position physically, and think, you know, what possibility is there for her to say, no, stop that, not like that. I told you what I wanted. Get out of this room. You know, it's a superhuman expectation to have of oneself. And yeah, it really seems formidable to me how the response is about what I failed to do, rather than look what happened to us. Look what's happening to all of us. There's a guilt as like a forgetting to share an experience, which the fact is that it's shared. And that applies not just to the birth thing, but to all kinds of other stuff. I kind of really urge people to read about the history of parenting, because it's a massive remover of guilt. It also, I had so many people after my first book ring me or write to me to say, I was so surprised that in reading your book, everything that I hated about my own parents and I resented about my own parents, because they punished me and frightened me and humiliated me and neglected me and all those kinds of things, I can now understand my parents so much better, because I can see that they were children to their parents, but it keeps on going back, and not just the parents. I can now see that psychology has got it all wrong in the West, that it's about mom and dad. They're the only people on the page. It's wildly delusional. You can't be that heroic to go that far beyond what your culture is either helping you to do or subtracting from you. You know, we're very dependent on support when we become parents. And I think guilt really is the sort of the symptomatic edge of just a gigantic and unrealistic self-expectation. It gets even more tragic when you realize that if I start feeling guilty and then just beating myself up because I was, you know, for all of the times that I've been a bad dad, which I have been sometimes, I you know, the times when I was, my anger got out of control, or my you know, I was too pushy or impatient or not knowing how to be playful in the way that my daughter wanted to. There's all kinds of moments of fatherhood in which I was a real disappointment to her and to myself. And I feel bad about that. I feel ashamed and I feel pain in my heart about that each time I remember. If I stop at the level of beating myself up for that, all of my excitement about learning and growing and healing just dies in that moment. So it's a kind of amazingly self-defeating narrative that drives that, you know. If I stop looking at myself in the mirror in this little silo and look out how everybody's a bad dad and a bad mum on a shitty day, or by definition, when things are triggered for you, everybody is on this growth, every last one of us. Half of the time, you're actually, if you think about it, like magnificent as a parent. Just because your heart just grew larger than it was before your child was born. They're too big for you. They break you open. I've seen that in everybody. Something changes in the face, and we really start to orient towards selflessness and care of others. Amazing what our children do to us to grow us up. So there are those days, and equally, this is why I wrote my third book, Inner Child Journeys, to understand why sometimes we disappoint our kids. We falter. A lot of it is when we are triggered. And there's no human in our lives that is a more powerful trigger than our child. By being, you know, the sound of their voice, the look of their face, by being little, they bring up feelings from when we were little. And we get flooded by that. If we don't begin to pay attention to that, most of what happens is blame. We'll either blame our child for their naughty, bad behavior or whatever, the fussy baby or whatever it is we project. It just turns to blame. And then we start manipulating the baby or the child. Or we self-blame, if that's more your style. Caning ourselves. Oh, what a bad mum I am. What a bad dad I am. And, you know, when you go into guilt, you know, everybody around you feels like abandoned. You've disappeared into yourself. You were here with me and now you're in there beating yourself up. I can't reach you anymore, you know. And that's a sign. If we can think of that, that's a moment that we've been triggered. Something's coming up from our own history. Now you've got something to work with that's really dynamic, filled with possibility. And the shitty day can turn into a door that opens onto huge personal healing and growth that you weren't going to do up until your child came and pressed on that button. Yeah,
that's great. I mean, you know, nowadays there is, you mentioned there's so much information out there, isn't there, about, oh, you know, you should do this, you shouldn't do that, you shouldn't feel stressed at all in pregnancy, all this kind of ridiculous stuff. And so, you know, people can have a kind of like an idea of a perfect thing, you know, a perfect relationship with your child or whatever. I really like Winnicott's thing, didn't he? What did he say? The good enough parent or the good enough mother? I really like that. Because also there's an element in that which is to do with, you know, things shouldn't be ideally perfect. In other words, like babies, children need some imperfection, if you like, in relationship and be able to repair. That process of disconnect and repair is very important, isn't it? So it's like, and that bring that builds up resilience. So even from the point of view of when, you know, when we talk about like birth trauma or early childhood trauma, it's very much to do with perception in the sense that you can use those events perhaps in a positive way. There's always a positive side to this. I'm wondering, resilience is a big topic at the moment, isn't it? And a lot of people are interested in resilience. Do you talk about that in your work?
Yes. And I think that the stuff of resilience is connection. That's the food for resilience. We're much more resilient when we feel well connected to ourselves and when we can trust that we can connect to one another well at the heart level, that connection is available. And that so connection with me, connection with you, that makes us astonishingly resilient as human beings. Astonishingly resilient. We don't just survive things, we grow from the things that fall apart, provided that we can have that kind of dialogue. So the things that I say to parents a lot is that the story doesn't end at the point of a traumatic thing happening. It's what happens afterwards is what makes an enormous amount of the difference. Because there's going to be the days when you're a good enough parent. There's going to be the days when you're just way past that and fantastic and glorious as a parent. There's going to be the days when you're a shit parent because you're breakable. You're human, limited, and breakable. And sometimes the stuff that lands on you is way too much, or the triggers that happen for you from that bring up things from your own past that you overcome you and overwhelm you. There'll be a moment when you're not the good enough parent, and that's true for all of us. And it doesn't end the minute afterwards where you've marked your child for life, and that mark will have your name on it. You know, it's the conversation afterwards that can make things even better than they were before the conflict, which is a two-way street of listening and inviting. That's part one of, oh my goodness, that didn't go well today. How did you feel when I said that, or when I yelled, or when I, you know, didn't come to watch your show, or I feel like I've let you down. How do you have a right of reply? So empowering our children to voice their feelings to us is just, I think we need to find a much more beautiful word than the word repair. I think it is a repair, but it's a beautiful repair. It's like the Japanese principle of wabi-sabi, that if you break a vase, you accept the break in there, but they patch it together with gold. And now you have a vase with a story in it that's been broken and you can see it. And that's the attractive part, the interesting part. It's the interesting part, the gold. It's because of how we hold those moments of injury afterwards. And the willingness to be vulnerable with our children, to acknowledge, I'm sorry, actually. I'm not happy with how I responded. That wasn't what you deserve. You deserve better than that. That was not my best me, was it? The humility, the honesty, that's a power. That's a strength. That's such a strength. And that's how we connect. It's a two-way street of emotional authenticity. And you're not likely to do that when you're crumbling in guilt. Guilt ends up being a very narcissistic place, just me thinking bad thoughts about me rather than reaching out to you. I distinguish guilt from remorse. They're opposite. Remorse is, if I've done something to wound you, it's remorse is my deep concern about you and your pain, and that I want you to have a repair moment. Guilt is, I'm just scared of being punished. Somebody's going to find out what a bad person I am, and I'm out there to get forgiven. So that's about me. That's not about you anymore. And they're sort of have an opposite direction to one another. One really helps, the other one doesn't. It keeps you stuck.
Great, beautiful. Mm. Thank you. I love the Japanese story about the vase. It's lovely.
Wabi-sabi. Google it. Wabi-sabi, Wabi-sabi. It's a whole philosophy of art and aesthetic and beauty. It's very profound.
Mm. Wonderful. Mm. Robin, I was wondering if you'd just talk maybe a little bit about your new book and what's in it and who's it for?
Yes, thank you. It's called Inner Child Journeys, and the subtitle is How Our Children Grow Us Up. I wrote it with parents in mind. Anyone that has children in their lives, teachers, I would love teachers to read it. Grandparents, elders. And it is an answer to guilt in many ways, that I don't want parents to just feel guilty. You know, I really want to help people to understand that how triggering works and how we can use those moments of when we are triggered as a growth opportunity for ourselves. And what we come back with then to our child is the more we get to know our inner child, that is the way through to understanding our children better, because our children, often their behavior, difficult or lovely behavior, either way, it's kind of a code. Their behavior is a language. They rarely will say directly what's going on for them, what they need, what they're afraid of. Often the behavior, the acting out, is a dramatization of what's on the inside. And it's by understanding our own inner child, when we feel stuck, confused, lost, helpless, you know, to begin by saying, well, what was that like for me when I was about that age, or when I would behave that way? Learning to have a dialogue with ourselves at that level when we have a bit of time away from the parenting relationship, just it brings so much insight, so much insight. So it's a double benefit of, it helps us to learn how to read our children better, and so much. It also shows us, it brings to consciousness and gives a name to the wounding that is still unresolved. The underneath our pain and our stuckness and helplessness, there's a need, an unmet developmental need. And then I show readers how to, once that need that is incompletely met, once that becomes conscious so that we can verbalize it to ourselves, it could be, I needed to be held more. I needed someone to make me safe. I needed someone to protect me. Or I needed to be allowed to speak my mind. Or I needed to be helped to, I needed to be allowed to play. They didn't let me play. They made me do homework all the time. You know, these incompletely fulfilled core developmental needs, that I show readers how you don't have to go back and be a child all over again. As the story's not over. Most of us are playing catch up with incomplete childhood cycles for the rest of our lives. That's the human condition. It's how it's meant to be. And so this is where it gets fun and creative. There is an adult appropriate way to say yes to that need, to meet that need. I was talking to one of my clients today, and the theme that came out through our conversation was about abandonment and loneliness. But it was around the not early babyhood, but more later childhood. And that had come up again and again in her life, and it continued. It's amazing how the themes of those injuries replay in our adult years up until we address the unmet need. For her, it was a need for tribe. We all need at some stages in our life of growing up to feel like we really belong to peer group. Three or four people that are temperamentally just right for us. And we identify, for a while, we need to kind of identify ourselves with that group. That was the thing that, it was an old, unfulfilled need that was really coming up for her now. And then the way through and forward, which felt very exciting, like she really lit up when we talked about it, is, you know, there are people out there that I just forgot how to reach out. I forgot to be faithful to myself that being with friends isn't a luxury, that I need to make, to take steps. You know, it's like a religious person will go to a temple or church. You don't go there once. There's a regularity to the thing. You know, we don't just need to go visit a tribe and come home and there I've done it. I just need to feel like that's available in my life because I make it so. And I need to go looking sometimes for who my people are. And that's just an example of, you know, the whole process of validating the inner child's need. And there's an answer that we can find now. I'm just thinking about John Lennon right now. There will be an answer. There can be. There really can be. And it's not a complicated thing.
Robin, can you talk a little bit about how you work practically with parents? Do you do any hands-on work, or is it do you tend to work with the whole family unit, or do you work more with individuals? Can you talk a little bit about that?
I will either be leading a whole group. Where after my you know, there might be a presentation and then there's a lot of question and answer, or I might be working with parents just privately in my practice. I've tended most of the time to just focus my attention with the parents, because I have I give less and less of the kind of talk about what your children need, you know, from that developmental understanding that I've been given from the sciences, et cetera, in my own therapy, et cetera, et cetera. It's more, I guess you could think of me as that part of the team, that there needs to be other players in the team as well. But what I focus on is what's coming up for the parent that blocks their view of their child. More and more, that's what I've been interested in. That I just found how, let's say, advice, if I give helpful, good advice, correct advice, that it doesn't land so long as the parent is feeling so triggered by their child that enacting a good parenting skill, it still doesn't connect because it's incongruous. You know, I can't be a good listener to you and say all the right things like, how did that feel? When inside I'm wanting to throttle you because I'm just so triggered because I've got these thoughts in my head about, you know, what a spoiled brat or that kind of stuff. Clearly, up until we have a conversation about how you were treated when you had your tantrum, your child will just be an irritant to you. And I find that when we do that work, it just opens up the heart to people don't even need to ask me anymore what they want to do for their child. The inner child is telling them loud and clear. It's become a little bit less hands-on. I began as a body-oriented psychotherapist. And there would be some biodynamic massage involved or some bioenergetic exercises to express and release pent up emotions and a whole range of things like that. It's I find I kind of evolved or changed towards, there's so much going on of that in the conversation. There's so much memory in the conversation, so much it's still body work without even getting up off our chair. It's body work to the extent that we're bringing awareness that is body inclusive in our dialogue, so that I'm not just telling you what I'm thinking, but this is what my solar plexus is feeling right now in relation to you. Then it's very much a body work.
That's wonderful. Yeah. So the insights are coming from them about the possibilities of change. I mean, that's one thing. In a lot of traditional body work, particularly when you're working with babies, for example, there's often a sense that the therapist is doing something to the baby, you know what I mean, and then giving the baby back almost like.
Yeah.
There's much less of a journey together, which I really, really like with the work that you're describing. Wonderful. I'm just wondering.
I often, by the way, that's my limitation. So I often find myself referring people. Many times I've referred people, I've said to people, geez, I really recommend that you go see a craniosacral therapist for your daughter, or infant chiropractor for your baby boy, or I love the sense of teamship there, that there's a particular voice that I use or a particular skill set that I love to bring in that is incomplete. There's other people have these gifts that are unlike mine, and when there's a teamship, holistic.
Fantastic. I was wondering, Robin, if you work online at all, because one of the things Our Birth Journey are doing is going to have professional consultations online for mums and professionals to get support from like this teamship that you're talking about, in interdisciplinary within the practitioners, but also being able to work and support families and children through the parents through online consultations.
Yes, I do. I do. So I have clients from sometimes from all over the world. We will be doing an online training. My current book came out about a month ago, Inner Child Journeys. And part of the purpose of that book is to accompany it with, I want to share that process, that inner child journey, or even how to have, even without doing a whole process, but how to just have inner child aware conversations with one another, so that we weave in that self-awareness just naturally and gracefully in and out of an ordinary conversation. Because there's nothing wrong with you and I sitting together at a barbecue in enjoying the sun. And I might say to you, gosh, I have all this trouble with my daughter. I don't know what to say. She's going to do this and is worrying me and whatever. And then just to pause and ponder and go, geez, I wonder how did my dad react to me when I did that? And how did it make me feel? We just bring in that in and out of conversation. I want to share with people how to do that in a way that's not invasive. It's driven by the heartfelt curiosity about one another. Because one of the things that I love is just how intimate we get, how people that can see the child in each other just become best friends.
Mm-hmm.
I love the loyalty and the friendship that it's such a generator of closeness. It's a tribe creator in a sense. That's what I want to share with people, that it doesn't have to be a formalized process. So I'll be doing that early next year as courses, empowering people to just, how do I bring this inner child curiosity to my everyday conversations when that could be a really helpful thing? And I want parents to be sharing that with each other because it's so supportive. not to only talk about what do I do for the baby that can't sleep, but what's that bringing up for me? Look at me. Why am I so angry all the time? You know, that's a beautiful place to go. It's not a place to feel bad. It's a wonderful thing to do. And then also, and that's with Kate White. She will be helping me to roll out a more formal 6-session online training for practitioners, for people that are already qualified as psychologists or other kinds of health practitioners, for how to deploy the inner child process a little bit more formally. And I've got different levels of it. You can go like snorkeling, or you can go scuba diving, or you can go deep sea diving with this stuff, so that it can be even more regressive. So yes, that was a long answer to your simple question. Brilliant. But yeah, there's going to be a lot of online, and I do online private sessions as well.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Robin. That was really wonderful. And so your books are available through in the UK as well, through Amazon, I guess.
Yes, Amazon, Book Depository. I'm not sure what other online sellers. I can't catch up with it all, but it's definitely available online. It's at as a paperback right now. And I'm not quite sure when, but it should be. I'll be releasing it as a Kindle book as well.
Yeah.
Probably towards the second half of 2020.
Brilliant. Great. And we'll keep everyone informed about your online courses and in-person courses. I don't know if you ever come to Europe, Robin. Do you come do stuff here?
Yes. I think I've been to the UK, I think, 3 times now. I spoke at conferences in London at the Tavistock Hospital. I spoke at Findhorn in the north of Scotland, kind of north. Well, no, it's by the North Sea.
Yeah.
Findhorn.
Yeah.
Near Inverness.
Yeah.
Beautiful community, magnificent place. I spoke there a couple of times. I've spoken in around some of my workshops in Edinburgh and in Glasgow. I loved it so much. I love being in the UK. So I'm an easy person to convince to come on over.
Brilliant.
Yep.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you. And thanks everyone for listening too. Thank you.
Great pleasure. Thank you so much.
Bye.